rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the sale goes on. They're just moving right along, step by step, selling off America, every little piece of it. This today's Wall Street Journal. Actually, this is the sale of the sale. This is just like the Ports deal. I mean, it's like the post-sale sale. Macquarie Bank Limited said it has agreed to buy U.S. water utility Aquarian Company from the United Kingdom's Kelda Group PLC for $860 million. Aquarian, one of the 10 largest privately owned water utilities in the U.S., provides water distribution and related services to 677,000 people in 52 communities in Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. You have to ask yourself this very simple question. Why would anybody want to buy a water supply, a city's water supply? Why would they want to buy the sewage system? Why would they want to buy the toll roads? Well, the simple answer is because they can squeeze money out of us. Just very simply, they can squeeze money. It's the reason why they want to buy our ports. As we reported yesterday, as the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday, and I shared with you yesterday, the profit margin on operating a port is around 30%. 30%. That's really quite extraordinary. On it goes. On it goes. We'll see how this thing shakes out. Christina Page is with us of ProChoiceMovement.com. And Christina, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you, Tom.
Your book, How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America, Freedom, Politics, and the War on Sex. Interesting topic coming up right here on the back end of this Supreme Court ruling. I'm assuming that you're familiar with it?
Yes, very.
Just moments ago it was announced that the RICO laws can no longer be used, or cannot be used, I guess they've been in abeyance for some time, cannot be used to stop organized protests, not just protests, blocking actions against abortion clinics or women's clinics in general. What's your take on this, Christina?
Well, I think that it's an invitation for more obstruction of women's, you know, physical passage into getting the health care that they are entitled to. And really, you know, it's just welcoming more extremism at women's health clinics.
Yeah, this was an 8-0 decision. Does that tell you anything?
Well, I think what it's a foreshadowing of things to come on the new court. You know, we've got a lot of important decisions like this heading up. You know, the South Dakota ban is heading, ban on abortion is heading towards the Supreme Court. We are facing the first federal ban on abortion, which is this late-term abortion ban, but will, you know, is written to ban anything past 12 weeks. It's written so broadly. So, you know, this is what we've been talking about for years and why the court is so critical in protecting women's access to legal and safe abortion care.
Christina Page, in your book, How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America, you suggest that the pro-choice movement literally saved America. How?
Well, first, it saved America from a wave of fundamentalism from washing over our sex lives. You know, today, what really the pro-choice movement is fighting is not just for safe and legal abortion, but the right to use contraception. I mean, the pro-choice movement, what I hope my book explains is that the pro-choice movement has done more of what the American public understands to be pro-life goals than the pro-life movement has. In fact, we're responsible for the dramatic decline in abortion rates in recent years. And this is true when you look across the globe. You know, countries that have enacted the boldest pro-choice policies experience the lowest rate of abortion in the world. And those that have adopted the strictest pro-life policies, where abortion is outlawed, contraception is hard to come by, they experience the highest abortion rates in the world, like Latin America. They have higher abortion rates than we do, even though abortion is banned. This is what we as a country have to understand and discuss. It's not about the morality of abortion. Once you take that off the table and say, yes, it's something we want to, you know, make unnecessary, then when you look at the actual solutions as to what's working, it's the pro-choice movement that's leading to the outcomes that all
goes,
Americans want.
Christina Page, it goes beyond just access to abortion, does it not? I mean, aren't the two primary
factors, variables here. Number one, easy access to sex education and in fact, you know, widespread availability of information about sex, sexuality, and how to prevent pregnancy. And number two, easy availability and access to contraception.
Exactly. Exactly. When we look at those countries like Sweden, where they threw out their abstinence-only policies in the 70s and enacted comprehensive, you know, fact-based sex ed programs, and then made contraception free. Mm-hmm. And what they witnessed was the sharpest decline in abortion rates that has ever been known. This is what we're instead experiencing here, and what the American people need to know is that the chaser, if Roe v. Wade is outlawed, or if we continue to restrict abortion as we have, is that the pro-life movement is not going to be furnishing Americans with the most effective pregnancy prevention methods. What we're experiencing now is that this is the second wave of activism of the pro-life movement, and it's to roll back our rights to family planning in general.
Right.
There's not one pro-life group in the United States that supports the use of contraception to prevent abortion, even though we know it's 85% effective at doing so. Instead, they're leading campaigns to keep emergency contraception from people, the first religious decision the FDA has ever made.
Mm-hmm.
So keep health insurers from covering contraception. This is in large part what my book exposes.
Right. We're talking with Christina Page. She's the author of the book, How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America, the subtitle, Freedom, Politics, and the War on Sex. And, Christina, you assert in your book that the pro-choice movement has, and prochoicemovement.com, by the way, the website, that the pro-choice movement saved America from a wave of religious zealotry and bigotry, I guess you could say. Aren't they back?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Aren't they back?
Oh, they're back. I mean, you know, it's like the pro-choice movement has been this levee that's kept, you know, this wave from the American people, but it's eroding.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it's interesting. We are by far the majority in this country. You know, not only just, I mean, 51% of Americans consider themselves pro-choice, but 66% want to keep Roe v. Wade intact and legal.
Right.
So what we're seeing is a third of the pro-life population in this country knows that by outlawing abortion, making it a crime, doesn't make it any rarer. It just makes it more dangerous for women to seek that service. So they know that there are better ways to reduce the need, and I think that that's the group that we really need to be talking with, the people who are genuinely interested in reducing the rate of abortion in this country, not simply, going for the political thunder of banning it, but really want solutions.
We're talking with Christina Page, the author of How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America. Christina, to what extent, you point out that there is not, to the best of your knowledge anyway, any so-called pro-life movements in the United States, essentially anti-abortion movements, that are also not, and now I'm starting to get into triple negatives here, let's state it as a positive, that all of the anti-abortion movements in the United States are also anti-birth control.
Yes.
Is that, to the best of your knowledge, true?
That is true. There's not one pro-life group in the United States that supports the use of contraception, but in fact, most are leading campaigns to misinform the public about how contraception works, reclassifying contraception as abortion, fighting in the FDA to keep proven methods from the American public.
Now, to the best of my knowledge, Christina, if you look at the history of, at least in my lifetime, there's been only one group that has been outspokenly opposed to both abortion and contraception, and that's been the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent is the Catholic Church involved in this thing?
Well, you know, I think that certainly this is a political arm of the Catholic Church, but, you know, what's so interesting, and I bring this up in my book, is that, for example, if a contraceptive coverage bill comes to a state legislature, the Catholic Church may lobby that it doesn't have to pay for contraceptives for its employees.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference is that the state right to life chapter will say, we don't want anyone to get coverage for their contraceptive method. So in some ways, the right to life movement is far more extreme than the Catholic Church and its lobbyists in this regard. But, you know, even...
Why?
What? Why?
Why?
Well, because I think that, one, what we're seeing is a much more fundamentalist...
This is really an attack on women, isn't it? Isn't this the, keep them barefoot, pregnant, and quiet?
Yeah, it's the attack on the modern family is really what it is. And, you know, in my readings of pro-life literature and their strategies, you know, what really becomes very clear is that the modern family is deeply offensive to the right to life, leaders in this country. They don't want to see women and men have the right to plan their families. They don't want to see women rely on child care.
Yeah, they just want absolute patriarchy. We're out of time. Christina Page, thanks so much for being with us. ProChoiceMovement.com is the website. The book is How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Looking forward, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Congress says, buy American. This is the Washington Outlook, but the Federal Highway Administration is going out of its way to choose Chinese. According to Brian Baird, congressman from Washington State, he says the government is circumventing the Buy American law so it can purchase foreign steel to rebuild the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, $6.2 billion project, so it could better withstand earthquakes. And Baird says that Caltrans, the California Transportation Agency, and FHWA are slicing up the project in ways that will allow them to buy Chinese steel. 320 million pounds of steel are needed. The Federal Highway Management, Highway Administration, FHWA, says they're deeply committed to Buy America provisions in federal law, in a statement, but because only state funds are being used, the law doesn't apply, they say. So I mean, just looking through what's going on right now, China imported 3.2 million barrels of crude oil a day in January, up 69% from a year earlier, as Iran became China's largest source of crude oil, custom data show. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. During January, Iran overtook Saudi Arabia and Angola, which were China's largest, top and second largest suppliers last year. So, I mean, it's just this water utility that I mentioned at the top of the hour. The Chicago Skyway Toll Bridge, this is pretty amazing. This is brand new. Guess who bought the Chicago Skyway? This is a major bridge, by the way. This was the first privatization of an existing toll road in the United States. It's a 7.8-mile toll bridge. Connects Chicago to Indiana and the East. And what are they doing? They're privatizing it. The city trying to get $900 million out of it. Yeah, but why would a private company buy it? Because they can make money on it. And if they can make money on it, then why sell it? Why don't we, the people, make money on it? Reduce our taxes. Well, because some cons in government said, our buddies would like to own this thing. 60% owner of the Chicago Skyway is now Grupo Ferrovial, a Spanish company. The 40% owner, Macquarie Infrastructure Group of Australia, they then sold their combined 100% to Cintra of Spain, bought 55% of this new group, and Macquarie Infrastructure Group out of Australia ends up owning 45%. So I'll bet you thought the Chicago Tollway was the property of Chicago. No. And there's no information regarding the bidder activity, level of interest to create bidder tension, stretching bids, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's just incredible. It's absolutely incredible. On it goes. Bush is off to India today. And what's he going to do? There's a big concern out there that India has never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, that they went ahead and built a nuke anyway. They did all the things that Bush is saying Iran should not do. And he's now going to reward them. A lot of countries very concerned about that. We'll get back to that a little after the bottom of the hour. But just a lot going on, from the Supreme Court today saying no to the use of the RICO law to the ongoing selling off of America. Lou Dobbs is having a spitting match with Dubai Port World, which, by the way, breaking news, Dubai Port Worlds has been participating with the Arab boycott of Israel and of Israeli products. Now, this is sure to add a little interesting spark to the fire. Our phone number, 1-866-440-8466. 440-THOM, Eric in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind today?
Hey, actually, two comments. One relative to your previous guest.
Mm-hmm.
I think the pro-choice side does themselves a disservice when they keep referring to the other side as pro-life. They ought to be referred to as compulsory pregnancy advocates.
Well, the problem...
It's a framing issue.
I understand that. And the problem with that is that they're not in favor of compulsory pregnancy, they're in favor of the compulsory maintenance of pregnancy once it's started. And one of the reasons why I haven't bought into that frame, because, you know, they're not pro-compulsory pregnancy.
No, but the other side is not compulsory abortion either, and the pro-abortion is kind of...
Right, that's why they say pro-choice.
Well, we do, yes, but they don't.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a framing, and I think when the pro-choice advocates are on there, when they keep using the term pro-life, it certainly makes the other side sound a bit more, you know, kinder and gentler.
Well, it's using the other people's frame.
Yeah.
I'm amazed by how many news organizations are now using the phrase tax burden.
I guess.
For example, which is one of the con frames but in any case, the other thing you wanted to
comment?
Right,
the other comment, just a quick comment, is just a comment on if you ever considered changing your theme music to Bruce Coburn's Trickle Down.
Oh, interesting.
It's the perfect song for I think, what your program represents.
I'm not familiar with it. I'll have to track it down.
Oh, you need to listen to it.
Yeah, but, you know, my favorite, I don't remember where I first heard it, who first said it. Maybe I did. I don't know. But my favorite on that is that with trickle-down economics, you get a nation of peons. And
right.
That's exactly what Reagan and Bush Sr. and Clinton, domestically, Clinton's economic policies were not all that nuts. They weren't certainly as nutty as what we have right now. And then Bush Jr. now, trickle-down economics writ large. Yes, let's give $550,000 to a multimillionaire or a billionaire and hope that they create one job. Makes a lot of sense, George. How did the media ever let that go by in any case? 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
They sell us the president the same way. They sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion. The same time they sell us our war. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the wire.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. That's Jackson Brown, Blood on the Wire. And if you go to jacksonbrown.com, there's an E at the end of Brown, jacksonbrown.com. Or, actually, I put a link to it off tomhartman.com. Jackson Brown has a new video out where he sings that song, and there's just an amazing video montage that goes with it. And you can see it over at Jackson Brown, BRONWE.com. Or if you go to tomhartman.com, up at the top, I just put a link directly to it. Because it's so remarkable. Jackson Brown is such a genius. It's just brilliantly done. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. Scott in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
I'm just wondering, what does the country have to gain from selling off a lot of its infrastructure, its ports and toll roads? I mean, what does the country as a whole have to gain from that?
We avoid bankruptcy. Here's what's happened, Scott. For the first 200 years of the history of this country, we balanced the interests of our internal interests, you know, the interests of average people, working people, businesses, and all that kind of thing, with the desire to have foreign goods by protecting American industries. In fact, the first tariff laws, a tariff is a tax on an import, the first tariff law was passed in 1787, the same year the Constitution was proposed, and in fact 2 years before the Constitution was ratified, and it was passed And it says right in the header of the legislation, to protect domestic industries. So the way it worked was, if you manufactured a pair of shoes in Connecticut, and there was a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes, and you could import that same pair of shoes from China, where there was only 10 cents worth of labor, then when those shoes came into the United States, we would hit them with a 90-cent tax to reflect the difference in the cost of labor, because the whole point of having an economy is so that people can have jobs. And for that reason, we made shoes in the United States for over 200 years. We don't anymore, for all practical purposes. So then what happened was Reagan started saying, this is crazy, we need to flatten the world. George Herbert Walker Bush pushed it even harder, asking for the power of the president to negotiate trade deals with individual countries where he could knock out these tariffs and just say, okay, it's a tariff-free zone or it's a free trade zone or whatever, this most so-called most favored nation status. Bill Clinton really kicked the thing wide open. I mean, he put some dynamite to the barn door and blew it up by pushing through and signing NAFTA and GATT. And then George W. Bush, of course, is pushing this even harder now. And so the result is that now countries can sell things in the United States with their cheap labor associated with it without any tariffs, without any import tariffs. If China wants to sell an automobile in the United States, they pay a 2% import tariff into the United States. If we want to sell, if General Motors wants to sell a car into China, however, China charges a 25% import tariff. So other countries are still protecting their markets. We're not. The result of this is that Americans have bought so much junk made from overseas. And some of it's not junk. Some of it's pretty good stuff. But nonetheless, we've bought so much stuff made overseas. I mean, you walk through any Walmart, everything, virtually everything is made someplace else, mostly in China. And it's not just Walmart. It's right across the board in our retail business. You walk around, you see these things there because they're cheap, because there's no tariffs anymore. And we have bought so much stuff that we ended up owing the rest of the world money. Last year, for example, we bought $700 billion more worth of stuff than the amount of stuff that we sold to China and to Europe and whatnot. So these countries out here all around the world are sitting on $700 billion U.S. dollars that we bought stuff from them, gave them dollars, and they're looking at these dollars going, these dollars aren't going to be worth a lot forever. You know, there's inflation and stuff. We need to buy real assets with them. And where can you buy real assets with dollars? In the United States. So those dollars have to come back into the United States. So it's sort of like if you owned a house and you were, you know, running up your credit cards and buying a big fancy car and all kinds of things way beyond your income, our income being what we're selling to the rest of the world, and your creditors start coming to you and saying, hey, listen, Scott, you owe us some money. And you say, okay, well, listen, how about you take the living room furniture? And they say, okay, cool, we'll take that. And then another creditor comes and you say, well, I'll give you the first quarter acre of my front yard. And they say, okay, we'll take that. And then another one comes and says, we'll take, you know, you owe us some money because you want to keep buying things from us because we keep, you know, you keep buying things from them. And so they say, you say, well, I'll give you the rest of the front yard. And so they take that. And pretty soon it reaches a point where they say, we want your front door. And that's what's, that's the threshold that we've hit with the ports. Is this making sense?
So basically, it's like the old expression, when a redneck needs money, they'll just sell the first thing they have to get money.
Well, and that's what Bush has done. And truth be told, it's not just Bush. This goes all the way back to Reagan.
Right.
This is a series of decisions that have been made by Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr.
So it's big business trying to get as much money as they can at the expense of all the American people.
That's correct. What you are seeing here, Scott, is George Herbert Walker Bush's New World Order. The New World Order is that the multinational corporations own America, and we have no say in it. And we can't say no to these companies because they've got the money, and we're in debt to them. It's like trying to say no to the bank when they come to repossess your house or your car. I mean, you know, you owe them the money.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Scott, for the call. I really appreciate it when people call and you know, ask for some clarification on these issues, because I think that there's some really significant issues here that a lot of people are very confused about, because there's a lot of demagoguery on all sides. I mean, here's Tom Friedman on Face the Nation over the weekend. He's saying, this whole security thing, it's a canard, it's nonsense. Well, you know, actually, here he is.
Anyone who's looked at this issue, though, knows this whole security issue is bogus.
Yeah, it's bogus. The whole security issue is bogus. Well, first of all, the security issue is not bogus, number one. You know, what's bogus is the Bush administration's approach to security. And number two, Tom Friedman has been one of the leading advocates of selling off America to the rest of the world. He started it with his book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, and he's pushing it now with his book, The World is Flat. Rob in Long Island, New York. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I'm listening to the media, listening to your station, listening to reading the papers, and I'm watching everybody talk about the security issue, which is no doubt it. However, you know, we've already exported all the jobs out. We've exported all the manufacturing out. And now my point is the economic side of this is why don't they ports are so busy because everything's coming into the United States based on the fact that we don't build it or make it here anymore. Why isn't anybody addressing the economic value of foreign countries owning the ports that are so busy because they've taken all the jobs out of America in the first place?
Yeah, well, what you're seeing is just the wide sweep of globalization. This is the direct consequence of a policy that suggests that individual nations are quaint, that the idea of a country having a border and protecting its border, that the idea of a country doing economically what's best for that country, that the idea of a democracy, a democratic republic, having a process whereby the people make decisions that are in their best interest first and foremost, and not necessarily in the best interest of the next country over, that idea is a quaint, dumb, old idea, and really what we need to do is just turn the world over to the pointy-headed bureaucrats at the big multinational corporations and the CEOs, and they'll tell us how to do everything.
I don't understand how if George Bush could put his foot down and take Iraq by storm, why can't he put his foot down and say, you know what, when it comes to the economic value, you know, the economic value of a particular situation, this is just the way it's going. If they globalized the manufacturing, you know, why do they have to globalize everything that we do? I live on Long Island. They just sold Keyspan to an English company.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and here I've got another one that just came across. Ferrovial acquires one of the largest construction groups in Texas, second largest infrastructure market in the U.S.
Right.
The Weber Group is involved in infrastructure, civil engineering, aggregate recycling, for over $400 million in assets. It goes on and on and on. I mean, you know, if you go to commondreams.org, there's a whole piece that I wrote there with a list of all the industries and what percentage of them are now foreign owned. What we are seeing is that the cons have sold out America, and there are Democrats as well as Republicans involved in this. They drank the Kool-Aid. They listened to Tom Friedman when he wrote his first book, Olive Tree and the Lexus, or whatever, however it was titled. I think that's the title. And they believed it, and they were true believers. They thought, oh, this is the solution to all our problems, and they were wrong. And we're seeing now that they're wrong.
Oh, clearly wrong.
Yeah.
This started with the Mexico, with the North American trade.
Right. NAFTA and WTO and GATT. They happened at the same time. And Ross Perot, that crazy old coot with the big ears who was talking about the sucking sound coming from the South, he was dead right.
Yeah, right.
And that's...
Do they think that there's any tie between the fact that the United Arab Emirates gave $100 million to the Katrina Fund and the fact that Bush, without knowing the deal, so he'd veto any legislation that would stop it?
No, that's just a complete coincidence, Rob. It's a complete coincidence. And by the way, I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you.
Yeah, right.
These guys understand that you grease a few palms, and the Bush palms are always greasable. I mean, this is the history of the Bush dynasty, going all the way back to Prescott and his doing business with Hitler. I mean, you know, he got busted by Roosevelt for doing business with Hitler when we were at war with Nazi Germany.
I'll tell you one thing, Tom. For the most part, 5% of the American population probably has a real good understanding of what goes on a political level. But it would take a fool to sit back and not, this is the most overt.
Yeah.
This is the most overt government I've ever seen.
I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you, Rob. These guys have they have taken brazenness to a new level. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hoping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number is 97% of the sound recording industries in the United States owned by foreign companies or persons. 79% of commodity contract dealing and brokerage businesses. 75% of our motion picture and sound recording industries. 65% of the metal ore mining done in the United States, foreign owned. 64% of our motion picture and video industries, foreign owned. 64% of our wineries and distilleries, foreign owned. 63% of our database directory and other publishers, foreign owned, as well as all book publishers, 63%. Our concrete industry in the United States, 62% foreign owned. Engine, turbine, power transmission equipment, 57% foreign owned. Rubber products, 53% owned. And on the list goes. This is just the beginning of the list. You can find the whole thing over at commondreams.org. Just click on the article that I wrote there. And why? Because 25 years of insane international trade policies have brought us to the brink of bankruptcy. And the only way we can get out of it is to sell off our country, or essentially to give away our country in exchange for the debt that we've run up by virtue of all the purchases that we're making at Walmart and all the other big box retailers that are carrying huge amounts of foreign-made goods rather than American-made goods. Really simple. And this, and by the way, this is not the fault of Walmart, and it's not the fault of the big retailers. It is the fault of our politicians who took apart our tariff laws that protected American industry. Very simple. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to ask two questions. First, about this like slave economy that Friedman loves so much. How do you stop the the things that function by virtue of the internet? It seems like the internet is something that happened independent of these agreements.
Right.
And then the second question is, are we fear-mongering and the left about Bush? I mean, it seems like we might be giving excuse to a lot of losers if they think they can't make it because of Bush, you know. I wonder whether, you know, we're guilty ourselves of fear-mongering.
I'm not sure that I understand what you mean there, Logan.
Just according to, like, just thinking that Bush is such a dark, demonic guy.
I think Bush is just a symptom of a larger problem, that permeates our government, and it's not limited to the Republican Party, although they're the main expression of it. And that is the absolutely amoral selling off of America, combined with both internally and externally, combined with the belief. The kind of Calvinist belief that wealth is a sign of a blessing from God, and therefore, and that we should have a country run by a wealthy elite, and it should be, you know, corporate power, corporate money, and inherited wealth. And this, by the way, was the argument that Alexander Hamilton was making back in the 1780s. It was the argument that John Adams was making when he was president of the United States in the 1790s. It's the argument that liberals like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and James Madison have been fighting against ever since the founding of this country. And we continue to. We continue to say, as Thomas Jefferson said, you know, I place my confidence in the people of the United States of America, not the rich. And which is not to say that, you know, we shouldn't have rich among us. There's nothing wrong with people making a lot of money in this country. But to have power, political power, be equated to economic power can be a very, very dangerous thing for democracy. That's the bottom line. With regard to controlling things on the internet, you know, your first question, Logan, you know, this is a tough one. And it's one that we have to figure out. I mean, it's really easy when a pair of shoes comes in to say, okay, here's a physical pair of shoes. We know that there's 10 cents worth of labor in it. On the other hand, when you've got General Electric, which was the first company to do this, this was all, you know, Jack Welch's idea, outsourcing to India their back office automation, you know, they're doing the bookkeeping there. How do you say, okay, if the bookkeeping were done in the United States, it would cost X, but it's being done in India, so it's costing Y, so we're going to put a tariff on it. It's possible. It's relatively, frankly, I think relatively easily possible to do that. It's the same way in Europe that they calculate value-added taxes. What is the added value here? How is it defined? And so I don't think that it's impossible. I think, in fact, it would be fairly straightforward, fairly easy to do. But that's the argument that the Friedmans of the world will make, is that, oh, you can't stop it. It's all being done over the Internet. Well, you can't stop it, but you can certainly tax it. David in Norfolk, Virginia. Hey, David, what's up?
How are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Your analogy earlier was good about, you know, how people are coming to collect our debt. But I think it's a little worse because, you know, you said, like, let's say they come back to your proverbial house and they want, you know, something, and you say, hey, we'll give you a couch. And they're going to say, no, we sold you that couch already. We can make one for 3 cents.
Right. We want your TV instead. We want your computer and everything on it.
Well, they probably need the computer, too. They're just going to want things that they consume, like oil, land, infrastructure, and things that they don't already have.
Yeah, most of our, I don't know the exact percentage, but a large chunk of our copper mines in the United States are foreign-owned. Our gold mines are foreign-owned. The largest mining company in the United States is Canadian.
Titanium mines, and, of course, the Hollywood movie studios is something they can't quite pull off yet.
Well, Sony owns an awful lot of that, and that's a Japanese company.
But there's so much debt. I think it's like $300 billion to China.
Last year, there's two different things. There's the trade deficit, which last year was over $200 billion out of $700 billion total. Plus, then on top of that $700 billion trade imbalance, which is what we've been talking up to this point, then on top of that, you got the fact that George W. Bush is not bringing in enough taxes to pay for the operation of government. So he's out there in the debt market borrowing money by selling treasury bills to the tune of $500-$700 billion a year, if you include the money he's borrowing from Social Security, to keep the government afloat, to make it look like our economy is functioning, when in fact he's giving that money to millionaires and billionaires and borrowing it in the name of our children and grandchildren. That's cash that's going to have to be repaid.
We have a pyramid scheme then with our own debt.
Oh, yeah. It's far worse than a pyramid scheme. Well, actually, no. Yeah, it's a Ponzi scheme. It really is in a lot of ways. It's a very good analogy, David. Thank you for calling and making it. It's a good point. All right, this is the Bush administration. It is all smoke and mirrors. And it's not, as I said, it's not just the Bush administration. Reagan was the guy who started this. And Reagan, Bush, and by the way, it's the old Jerry Ford Reagan crowd who are back. You know, who was Jerry Ford's chief of staff? Our current vice president, Dick Cheney, who was his secretary of defense, our current secretary of defense, Don Rumsfeld. I mean, these guys have been in the Republican Party for a long, long time, and now they're realizing their dream of taking apart America.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. New opportunities for growth in the United States, plus future synergy between businesses. So goes the news release about Ferrovial acquiring one of the largest construction groups in Texas, a company from Spain. It's just on and on it goes. I mean, it never seems to stop. And this is what I keep saying. The port deal is a symptom of a larger problem. Yes, it's problematic in and of itself, but it's also a symptom of a larger problem, and that is the 25 years of flat-earth economic policies, of Thomas Friedman economic policies, of conservative economic policies, of corporatist economic policies. 25 years of this have left America broke and in the mud. And we're saying to the rest of the world, come pull us out of the mud. That's not the best metaphor that one could come up with. But these guys have just driven us into it's a disaster what they've done to this country. And meanwhile, by the way, happy Fat Tuesday. Fat Tuesday, of course, the word that translates into, I think it's French, into Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras, I believe, is the French word for French phrase for Fat Tuesday, the day before Ash Wednesday, the day you want to pile in as much as you can and party hard if you're Catholic, so that you can begin fasting on Ash Wednesday. And down in New Orleans, they're partying hard, and God bless them. Here you have a city whose major industry, and I say this, you know, having spent not unreasonable amount of time, and I've been to New Orleans, frankly, I don't know how many times. I don't know, a dozen times or so in my life, usually to do business. Actually, probably more like 20 times. Used to teach a lot of seminars down there and workshops and things. And it's a city that has, as I don't know if it's its total primary business, but certainly one of its primary industries. Obviously, a lot of its business has to do with the Port of New Orleans, you know, the port business. Which the profit from which, by the way, will soon be going to Dubai, used to go to England. But the industry in New Orleans, the profit of which stayed in New Orleans, therefore good business, was tourism. And so I think it's absolutely wonderful that they are trying to revive the economic core of the city, which is tourism, with the big annual gig that they have to bring tourists in, which is Mardi Gras. And it's a little late now to encourage people to go down to New Orleans for Mardi Gras because it's going to wrap up today, but good on them for doing this, and good to see. Other news, this I'm reluctant to know how to even approach this thing. The Bush administration, you'll recall back when Brownie was supposed to be doing something about New Orleans, instead, on that Monday, he went to a workshop on the bird flu. Now, if something had come out of Brownie going to the workshop on bird flu, like the Bush administration having a comprehensive policy to deal with bird flu if and when it hits the United States, and most scientists agree it's not if, it's when, then, you know, it may, in retrospect, 5 years from now, looking back, we may say, hey, you know, Brownie should have gone to that thing on bird flu. That was actually more important than Hurricane Katrina. Now, that assumes that people can't chew gum and walk at the same time. You know, I'm speaking semi-facetiously here. The reality is that if he couldn't have done something about Katrina, he certainly could have delegated it, or he should have been able to do both. But the point is that he said, instead of Katrina, he was dealing with bird flu, when, in fact, when we look back at it, there's nothing coming out of this about bird flu either. And now, this report is coming out. This is from the Associated Press. The big fear about the flu, the bird flu, is that it would jump species. And particularly that it would jump species from the avian world, from the bird world, because this is a virus that is easily communicated between birds, to the mammalian world. Once it becomes a virus that's easily transmitted in mammals, we've got a problem, because we're mammals. The Associated Press is reporting that the deadly strain of bird flu, the H5N1 virus, was confirmed today in a cat in northern Germany. This is very bad news, or it has the potential to be very bad news. If it's one isolated cat, just like so far, it's just been isolated humans. Humans are mammals, too. Obviously, this thing has jumped to humans. But we don't know how this jump occurred. We don't know what happened inside the cat. We don't know how the cat got exposed to it. It's a lot of we don't knows, but this has the potential to be very bad news. You'll recall the best epidemiology and, I don't know what the medical term is for tracing back the origin of a disease, but in any case, the best that they could do with regard to the last time H5N1 swept the world, which was the Spanish flu virus, of the Spanish flu epidemic, the pandemic of 1918, was that birds brought the virus, in all probability from Asia, in the spring, about this time, as they migrate south to Kansas, to an army base in Kansas. And there, those birds infected pigs. In the pigs, the bird virus merged with a mammalian virus, a swine flu virus, if you will, and created a new form that was easily transmissible from pigs to humans. And the humans at that fort in Kentucky, that military base in Kentucky, then shipped out to World War I over to Europe. And a number of them started out in Spain and started spreading it among the Spanish population, which is why it's referred to as the Spanish flu. And it spread across Europe, and then as the troops were coming home from Europe from World War I, they brought it back all across the United States, and boom, we had this horrible epidemic. I remember my mother, who is now in her 70s, telling me stories that her father told her and her mother told her about what it was like when they were alive during the flu epidemic, of her father going from house to house with his long black coat on in the winter during the flu epidemic, carrying cans of food to neighbors who were shut in because they had the flu, and people were afraid to go visit them. And people, you know, dealing with bodies and you know, the mortuaries and the morgues being overwhelmed and the hospitals being overwhelmed and all this kind of thing. So I would be a little more comforted, frankly, if the Bush administration had any kind of policy, any kind of plan at all. But as far as I can tell, and as far as most of the press reports go, the Bush administration, by and large, they've been saying, you know, we got to have tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, and we got to make sure that the United Arab Emirates can buy our ports. And these are the priorities. So bird flu, smird flu. And in fact, you know, all the Tamiflu, the one drug that may prove effective against this, the manufacturers in Switzerland and their supplies, their manufacturing capacity has been bought out more than a year in advance by the Canadians and by the French and by the Germans, the countries that have national health care plans. You know, the national health care plans, one of the things that they're charged with doing is looking around and saying, you know, what's coming down the road? What are we going to need? Because they've got to buy drugs and they want to negotiate decent prices. And so, you know, are we going to need a particular amount of this particular antibiotic, or are we going to need this antifungal, or are we going to need this new chemotherapy agent, or are we going to need a vaccine against the bird flu, or are we going to need Tamiflu? And they go out in the marketplace and they negotiate the purchase and, you know, they buy the stuff. Well, here in the United States, that's actually against the law. It's against the law. This is what the Republicans brought us. In fact, Billy Towson, the congressman from Louisiana, as I recall, who was chairman of the House committee that put together the Medicare drug bill, who is now working with a salary of $2 million a year for the lobbying firm for the big drug industries, pharma. Billy Towson wrote into that law, into the Medicare bill, that it is against the law. It is a violation of federal law for Medicare to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies. So not only do we have no official policy, not only do we have no plan, but we've even blocked the possibility of it. So let's see. The Bush administration's accomplishments. They're really rather extraordinary. Outed a CIA agent, Valerie Plame, and brought down Brewster Jennings, the company, the phony front company that she ran, which was interdicting weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, particularly in Iran, leading to the death of CIA assets all over the world. We still don't know how many. That's still to go. The selling off of American ports. The list, it's just... Oh, man. Now I sound like I'm complaining. It's just, please, we need rational, competent leadership in the United States, and you and I can help make that happen in November. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Today you're working for the man. Well, pick up your feet. We got a deadline to meet. I'm gonna see you make it on time. Now, don't relax. I want elbows and backs. I want to see everybody from behind. 'Cause you're working for the man.
And welcome back, my friends, to the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. Boy, you know it's getting bad when their friends start picking on them. Here in the Washington Times, Rowan Scarborough, I wonder if he's related to Joe, the headline, U.S. lacked plan for rebuilding Iraq. We were just talking about the complete failure to have a plan for bird flu. Now, the Washington Times, the Bush administration, never drew up a comprehensive plan for rebuilding Iraq after the March 2003 invasion. And the lead sentence. We'll get back to that. We're going to get back to your phone calls, discussion of privatization and free trade and just the ports and the whole thing here in just a few minutes. First, Ellen Ratner and Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service are down in Mississippi today. And Ellen, Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Actually, we're going to switch off here. But
okay.
Essentially, no plans to rebuild for Iraq. How about Mississippi and New Orleans? I'm in Mississippi here. We just finished at 10th City. We have a bunch of people from Past Christiana, a city that was completely leveled, living essentially in tents, and FEMA is now going to cut off their money from this, and they're going to cut off their money because they're just going to cut it off at the 15th. So we don't even know where these people are going to go. Some people are even sleeping in their car down here.
Well, and, you know, the conservatives say, why don't they just pull themselves up by their bootstraps?
That, yeah, right, exactly. And what's amazing is that in areas where they hired private contractors, you know, the local cities hired private contractors, places have been cleaned up. Where they hired the Army Corps of Engineers, such as in Pass Christiane, because the mayor just almost had a nervous breakdown and essentially left, there has not been much appreciable cleanup. And I've been here now, I mean, I was here 20 days after the storm. Today is 6 months after the storm.
And still nothing going on. Now, is this
I'm going to turn this over to Greg for his impressions, and
okay.
Then you can come back to me.
Okay, thanks. Ellen Ratner, Greg Gorman coming on the line with us. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Tom. Well, yeah, you know, this is my first time to actually be here since the hurricane. I haven't been here yet, but I used to spend a lot of my childhood down here, so I have a point of reference. And I'm just absolutely overwhelmed by the amount of destruction that's still on the ground in places like Biloxi and Gulfport and Pass Christiane and DeLille 6 months after the hurricane. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, like Ellen just mentioned, we've just left what's called Tent City, and it's quite literally green tarp tents.
It looks like a wrap.
You built out of wooden frames.
Ellen
says it looks like Iraq. I said it looks like something, you know, you've seen on MASH, which I used to watch as a kid. I mean, that's what it looks like. And it's, you know, there's a big food tent. There is a television room. There's a big laundry room. And people are living their lives. I mean, it already feels like a neighborhood. People are walking around saying hello to their friends. There are lots of volunteers there.
But how are they surviving? I mean, not only were their houses wiped out, but their businesses were wiped out as well. So these people don't have paychecks, they don't have income, and our government, the FEMA, is now saying to them, take a hike?
Well, that's right. And, you know, we spoke to several people just now who are not working. We even spoke to someone who came to Tent City because neither her home nor her car were insured. So she's not even waiting for a check. She knows the check's not coming, and this is her last resort at this point. And like Ellen just said, they're expecting to be closed down on March 15th when the FEMA money runs out, and these people don't have a plan B at this point. So they're living here, they're eating here, they're sleeping here. We went in one of the tents. You know, it's a big room. It's got wooden floors. It has air and heat. But, you know, it's a basic room, and it's not very comfortable. And
Greg Gorman,
this place, they'll leave.
Greg, this is America. This is not Pakistan. I mean,
Tom, that's a perfect, you know, that's exactly how I felt. Walking through the rooms, I said, this looks like something you see on MASH, which was, you know,
in Korea.
1950s Korea. And
right.
This is, you know, the United States of America in one of the 50 states in 2006. 6 months after a natural disaster that people knew was coming with a few days' notice. And, you know, like I said before, we drove through Biloxi, we drove through Pass Christiane, there are still houses down, there's trash and debris all over the street. It looks like the hurricane could have happened 3 or 4 days ago, not 6 months.
Is there a finger-pointing contest going on between the state and federal officials about who's responsible?
Well, it seems like, you know, we all know how much blame there is to go around. I talked to a lot of people here, and I'd say 75% of them were happy about their FEMA experience. Mm-hmm. What they were unhappy with is how long it took to get the trailer, how hard it was to hook the water up, how hard it was to hook the sewage up, how long the insurance has taken, and the infinite problems that they've had with their insurance, meaning, you know, did you have flood insurance versus hurricane insurance? How much money did you get? How much were you covered for? How much money have you actually received? How will I rebuild a house on a fraction of what I had before? Those kinds of questions, you know, unfortunately, people are still asking 6 months later, and it doesn't look like it'll be ending anytime soon.
This is a tragedy of biblical proportions. I mean, it compounded by incompetence of biblical proportions. I mean, this is pharaonic. It's incredible. Greg Gorman, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Greg, for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
says the Bush administration, now it comes out, the Bush administration never drew up a comprehensive plan. This is from the Washington Times today, the right-wing Mooney-owned newspaper, the only newspaper Bush will read. When he does read, the Bush administration never drew up a comprehensive plan for rebuilding Iraq after the March 2003 invasion, which contributed to a severe shortage of skilled federal workers in Baghdad and to the mismanagement of the country's oil money, according to a new government report. Stuart W. Bowen, Jr., the inspector general for Iraq reconstruction, said there, quote, there was sufficient insufficient systematic planning for human capital management in Iraq before and during the U.S.-directed stabilization and reconstruction operations. Yeah. So they got no plan to rebuild Iraq. They have no plan to rebuild the Gulf Coast. They have no plan to deal with bird flu. They have no plan to deal with our ports. They have no plan to deal with the potential of terrorism. They do have a plan, however, to spy on you and me. They want to know what's going on with our phone conversations. They want to know what groups we're belonging to. They want to put RFID chips into our driver's licenses with their real ID legislation. They got a plan for you and me, my friends. But they don't have a plan for any of this other stuff. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. As they say. George in Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Tom, I think I have an idea which might solve a couple of problems.
Okay.
If we did what the Europeans do, they have a 20% sales tax over there. That's used to help to fund their medical single-payer plan, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If we would add a 20% sales tax on all imported items and use it for a single pay a plan, we would win.
Both. Yeah, well, it's not called a sales tax when it's on imported items. It's called a tariff. And that's how we built this nation. Did you know, George, that 100% of the operating budget of the federal government from the founding of this country until the Civil War was from tariffs?
I know that.
And so, you know, I agree with you that we should go back to a tariff-based system. It would not only cause companies to say, hey, if we can make it in the United States for the same price, let's just make it here, particularly
that's
given the increasing
right.
price of oil. But it would also generate revenue for the government that they could use to do things like paying down the debt and the deficit and rebuilding Hurricane Katrina and having a plan for bird flu and on and on and on. I absolutely agree with you. With regard to it being a sales tax, I just have to correct you. Europe does not have a 20% sales tax. What they have is what's called a value-added tax in most European countries.
Well, they have a sales tax, too. I looked that all up. So they have value-added plus a sales tax, okay?
Yeah.
Every one of the countries do, from 15 to 20%. And therefore, that's about the kind of money you need to pay for single-payer health care.
Well, that's interesting. I lived in Europe for a year, and I spent a lot of time there. I was in Europe just 4 weeks ago. I don't recall any sales tax being added onto anything. I thought that this was all entirely value-added tax.
No, that's not the case. But what I'm saying is that would be equivalent to a tariff, essentially.
Sure.
And
yeah, well, if it was only, I mean, you know how a value-added tax works. Every stage along the way, you know, when ore is made into steel, they tax it because its value is increased. When the steel is made into sheet steel, they tax it because the value has been increased. When the sheet steel is made into a car door, it gets taxed because its value has been increased. When the door gets made into a car, it gets taxed because its value has been increased. And, you know, every step along the way, there's that value-added tax added. And so the consequent result is essentially a sales tax. It's a tax that the consumer is paying, but it is buried in so many layers of manufacturing and distributed throughout the economy so broadly that most people don't perceive it as a sales tax.
Right. But the point is, this is how to get us away from this nightmare, because I have a fear that if we don't do something this year, the dollar is going to collapse, and then what's going to happen?
Oh, I agree. In fact, here's my fear, George, that in November the Democrats will take the House and or the Senate. And in December, January, February, probably right after January, after the Democrats take power, that this train wreck that the Bush administration has set up will hit. The dollar will collapse. Gold will go to $1,500 an ounce. Oil will go to $200 a barrel. The U.S. economy will go into the tank. Our unemployment rate will hit 15, 20%. Housing, you know, you'll see 10, 15, 20, 30% of all home mortgages, people just literally walking away from them. We will be in a Great Depression or in a depression. And the Republicans will try to blame it all on the Democrats who just got elected.
Well, I don't think that people will be that stupid.
Well, let's hope not. Let's hope not. George, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Ike in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Ike.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for listening to us on KRXA there in Santa Cruz.
Great. Yeah, it's a great show. I just wanted to let you know about the Tamiflu thing. It's even worse than you think. So this drug, Tamiflu, is manufactured by Roche, but the intellectual property rights are owned by a company in California called Gilead.
Right.
And guess who was Gilead Research's chairman of the board from 1997 until 2001?
Don Rumsfeld,
yeah. Exactly.
And yeah, so, this also, if you also want to know another scary story about Rumsfeld and this kind of thing, just, you know, Google Rumsfeld and aspartame.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was the guy who brought aspartame to the American public. He was, when he was the chairman of the company that was making aspartame, and the FDA turned it down because they said when it's in the body, it gets metabolized and converted into formaldehyde in the liver, and it's toxic. And he pulled a few strings, and so we got aspartame. Now, at least that's my understanding. I may be wrong on that. You know, I should qualify that. I'm not an expert on this. But this is what I've been told. This is what I've read. So.
And it just seems to me that this is just an attempt to pump up Gilead's stock. I mean, it's gone from $35 a share to $47 a share since the bird flu scare came out. And, you know, it doesn't tell even sure if this drug is even effective for bird flu.
Well, we won't know until the flu virus actually appears.
But it seems if you really want to defend the American public against an epidemic, what you want to do is arrange for a situation where visits to emergency rooms suddenly go from one a day to 100 a day. And that doesn't mean buying drugs. It means training doctors and things like
right.
that.
Building a medical infrastructure. And Bush's answer to building a medical infrastructure, let's have health savings accounts.
Oh.
We're going to let you put aside $1,500 a year and get a health insurance policy with higher deductibles. Aren't you happy?
No, why? I mean, it's just, you know, it's just corporate ripoffs.
It is.
You can't believe. I mean,
well, you have to get it that these guys really and truly believe, and this is where this is kind of it gives you back your faith in human nature, and at the same time, it's scary. The part of the story, these guys really and truly believe in their heart of hearts that if corporations run America rather than we the people, rather than a democratic process, that things will be better. They really believe that. And this whole thing of an elite corporatocracy running the country, this is what they're all about. And it's they're true believers. I'll have to give them that. They're doing it. So,
wow.
Ike, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
It's good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I am just great, but I'll get better, Dick.
Hey, this one I was telling your screener, I'm for the Coast Guard to control the terminals and control these ports because I think we depend on them for valuable resources, and please, administration, don't shut them down.
Well, you know what the Coast Guard does, Dick, is they, by and large, they look for safety issues. I mean, you know, when Scotty McClellan made his disingenuous comment at the press briefing, 3 days ago, and he said
right.
The Coast Guard inspects 100% of all the ships coming in. They do.
Yeah.
They inspect them to make sure they have enough lifeboats and fire extinguishers.
Right.
I don't have at the tip of my fingers the total staff of the Coast Guard, but there's no way that even the entire staff of the entire United States Coast Guard, if every member of the Coast Guard in the entire United States was just brought to the coast, to the port of Los Angeles, that
yeah.
they could inspect all the containers coming through there.
Yeah.
It's not what they were designed to do. It's not their job. And which is why it's been largely privatized. The,
right.
the shipping companies are the ones who do the inspection.
Right.
We just set the rules. Just like you and I pay our taxes, the IRS
yeah.
doesn't calculate our taxes for us. We do it, and it's on the honor system,
right.
which is one of the reasons that a lot of people are a little concerned about a company owned by a country that doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist, that is participating in the Arab ban of Israel,
yeah.
that has ties to the 9/11 hijackers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Have a good day, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dick. Good day. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Ken in Seattle. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Ken. Tom, you know, this is actually a redo. If you look at what happened in the early 1900s, it was run by the rich people, the robber barons, the railroad barons and all that. And then we went through the bad times, and we got a middle class. Well, they're just doing it again. It's always been run by the rich, and it's going to fail the same way it failed the last time.
Yep.
Only worse,
but
the same direction.
Yeah. You're singing my song, Ken, and it's not about sitting around being dreadful pessimists or anything. It's about looking at the lessons of history and saying, hey, you know, we're intelligent enough to learn from history.
Yeah,
we did that before. Don't think we should do it again because it didn't work.
Well, these people, you know, it works for them okay.
Well, yeah, you're right. The Vanderbilts came out of the Gilded Age very well, and the Carnegies, and the on and on it goes. But there was functionally very little middle class, very little of a middle class in the United States between 1880 and 1930. And what little middle class there was agriculture based entirely.
Absolutely.
And they were,
the middle class in this country is on its way out the door.
Yeah.
I mean, they're sending the jobs over, at all levels. Now they're complaining about, like you were saying on your show, where the people from India are doing the white collar stuff and people from China are doing the blue collar stuff.
Yep.
What's left for us?
Yeah. Well, and that's the amazing thing. I mean, this study that was in Paul Krugman's article yesterday in the New York Times, where he pointed out that it's not the big myth that's being sold by the Friedmans of the world and the Bushes of the world is we can just educate our way out of it. If we just give enough people enough good education, if we give access to college to more people, that a college degree is going to solve all problems. And it turns out that it's not that, the 20th percentile, the top 20% who are college educated, who are making all the money. It's the 0.001 top percentile who are making all the money. It's pretty amazing. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. It's the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. Ben Bernanke's speech to Congress here seemed to go fairly well, Paul Krugman notes. However, he was promoting one of the great myths of our day, which is promoted by these flat worlders and everything will be just fine if we turn everything over to the corporations, folks. Which was basically the old 80-20 fallacy, as Paul Krugman calls it, which is that the 20% or so of American workers who have the skills to take advantage of new technology and globalization are pulling away from the 80% who don't have the skills. However, notes Krugman, and this is from his article, Graduates versus Oligarchs, however, highly educated workers have done better than those with less education, but a college degree has hardly been a ticket to big income gains. The 2006 economic report of the president tells us that the real earnings of college graduates actually fell more than 5% from the time Bush became president to 2004. Over the longer stretch, from 1975 to 2004, the average earnings of college graduates rose by less than 1% a year. So who's making all this extra money? Well, they decided to break it out. And they found that the 99th percentile, that means that out of 100 people, 99 of them are below you economically. So we're talking the top, not 1%, one percentile, had an income increase of 87%. Now, if we're talking college graduates, it'd have to be like the 80th percentile. But no, we're talking the 99th percentile. Income at the 99.9th percentile rose 181%, and income at the 99.99th percentile rose 497%. Now, let me just give you what this means. What this means is that people who are making the 99th percentile is people who are making an income of $402,000 or greater. So if those people who are making more than $400,000 a year, they saw their income rise since Bush became president by 87%. The 99.9th percentile is those people making more than $1.6 million a year. And so the people who are making more than $1.6 million a year, they saw their income rise during Bush's presidency 181%. The people in the 99.99th percentile, that's people who have an income over $6 million a year, they saw their income rise by 497% since Bush became president. And what Krugman points out is that what this means, this has got nothing to do with education. What this means is that an oligarchy is emerging in the United States. An oligarchy is rule by a small number of very wealthy people. It's like Mexico being run by 36 wealthy families. There's about 20 families that control most of the business in the Philippines. You find oligarchies all over the world, third world countries. The typical pseudo-democracy is actually an oligarchy. And it looks like what we're seeing here in the United States is the emergence of an oligarchy. Not good. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. It occurs to me that if there is no rebuilding really happening from the feds in New Orleans, you may recall that right after it happened, Bush took it as another occasion to allocate several $1 billion to Halliburton for that very purpose. And if they found other uses for those funds, this administration is pure criminal, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you a bit, Dave. Not a bit. Not a bit. Linda in Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I'm really confused with the mixed bag of reports I'm getting from the media on this port deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I came to you for answers.
Okay.
First of all, when this first came out, I heard Senator Mendez from New Jersey say, this is the first time ever we had a sale of a port to a foreign government, okay?
Right.
And I believed him.
Right.
So then I start hearing, well, we're not selling it, or they don't own the whole thing. So then I hear another company is owned, and the one in California is owned, and then I heard the governor of California saying, no, we lease it, so we control the actual port.
Right.
And I'm understanding that's not the case with this sale.
Well, here's how it all works. The dirt on the ground is owned by, in almost all these cases, is owned by the local municipality or the state. It's owned by some governmental agency. On top of that dirt, you have built a port. A port is a facility that where a ship can pull into, you know, and dock. That port is being leased, or the lease is being sold. Now, in the case of Dubai Port World, Dubai Port World is owned by the guy who happens, but in large part, the guy who happens to be the head of Dubai, which is one of seven countries that make up the United Arab Emirates. It's this little group of seven countries, and each one of these countries is actually an ancient kingdom. They're not democracies. So you have this guy who's the king of Dubai for all practical purposes. They call him emirs over there. The emir, he and his family own this company. And so technically you could argue, no, it's a company that's buying it. Or technically you could argue, no, it's a country that's buying it. Because the country owns the company. Because the country is owned by the guy who owns the company. He also owns the country. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but it's not being leased, as they're trying to tell us.
Well, I believe that what's being sold is a long-term lease. These are like 40, 50, 60-year leases. So the effect is the same as ownership. But the lease is to have the port on the land. But they're actually buying the port facility. They're buying the docks. They're buying the equipment. They're buying the physical port.
Right.
They're just leasing the physical port that sits on top of the dirt that happens to be at the edge of the water.
The other thing is this 45-day situation.
Yeah, the 45 days. The law requires that any sale of any property in the United States that's going to anybody where there might be national security concerns should automatically have a 45-day investigation. That didn't happen in this case. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. We're going to, as we move along here, we've got a lot coming up. We have a Berlusconi alert for you. What do the U.S. troops want in Iraq? We're going to get into that. A little more about the port deal, some more information about this so-called compromise that's in the works. Cons spinning this thing as fast as they can. and we'll be getting to your phone calls as well. First, however, our Bioneers guest for the week. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.org, their website. And our guest today is Charlotte Brody. She's the executive director of Commonweal, a nonprofit health and environmental research institute in Bolinas, California. Hey, Charlotte.
Hi.
Welcome to the program. I see safecosmetics.org as a website. Is that? I thought Commonweal had its own website.
We do have our own website, www.commonweal.org.
Okay, great. And tell me, what is Commonweal up to these days?
Well, we're up to a lot, as usual. Commonweal began working with children in trouble, and we still do juvenile justice work at the state and national level. But the biggest piece of our program that's developed since then has been the work that links the health of the environment and human health, how what makes water contaminated, how what chemicals get into products also end up getting into people and impacting our health. And that's how the work is linked to safe cosmetics and healthcare without harm and a lot of other work that we do.
I think it's fascinating how you were one of the early whistleblowers, isn't the right term, but I don't know of a better one. People out there speaking out about how the healthcare industry was generating toxins that are killing us, that are causing us to need the healthcare industry.
That's right. And for me, it came out of my experience running a Planned Parenthood in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the mission of Planned Parenthood that we really lived every day is to keep young women healthy until they're ready and willing to become mothers. And so when I learned that every bag of medical waste that I was sending off to an incinerator and trying to figure out how to afford was ending up being more dioxin that came back into the breasts and eventually into the breast milk of the women we were trying to serve, it made me crazy.
Because it was being burned and put into the atmosphere, you mean?
That's right. That when you burn anything containing chlorine, dioxin is produced. Dioxin is combusted chlorine.
Mm-hmm.
And so burning turns out to be not what I thought of, which is, you know, somehow you burn something and it just all goes away.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that that's not the way chemistry works, that if you put a mercury fever thermometer into a fire, an incinerator, anything else, that mercury doesn't break down. That's what an element is. It doesn't
right.
break down. It goes up into the atmosphere and eventually down onto the ground and into an animal, often a fish, and then back into us. So when I really began to understand that every bag of medical waste that we burned ended up contaminating the women we were trying to serve, and men too, and children too, I wanted to do something about that. And luckily, I got to be around other people that also wanted to do something about that, and Healthcare Without Harm was born.
And so what are we doing now as opposed to burning our medical waste?
Well, it's, you know, it's a really wonderful story. I mean, we hospitals have figured out safer alternatives. You can make waste hot enough to decontaminate everything that's in it without setting it on fire.
Hmm.
And there are a variety of techniques, some as simple as, you know, just sort of steam sterilizing, which medical
right.
people have known how to do forever. But there are now giant versions of this that in a much more environmentally friendly way deal with waste. And at the same time, over the last decade, Healthcare Without Harm has helped hospitals become really good recyclers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking a lot of this stuff. It seems, for example, the mercury in the thermometer. I mean, there's mercury is being bought and sold in the marketplace. There's a lot of they use mercury, for example, to make fluorescent lights. So if there's a market for it, why just burn it and put it up in the atmosphere when you could resell it?
That's right. In fact, there's already too much mercury on the marketplace, so that mercury
right.
is now being recycled and stored like we store nuclear waste, right? Just in big barrels. Because there's more than we need, because we've done a pretty good job, with the exception of fluorescent bulbs, which need to be recycled so the mercury can be recaptured. All other uses of mercury are really on the decline. Healthcare Without Harm played its part in a national effort to move away from mercury fever thermometers, mercury blood pressure devices, mercury in vaccines, all the other uses, so that we don't mercury just turns out to be a metal that's too dangerous for us to work with, and we just need to figure out how to not use it. Coal-fired power plants are the big problem that are harder to address through just safe technology, because the mercury is in the coal, and there's no really good way to keep it from getting out of the air.
Now, Brian Schweitzer, who's the governor of Montana, is on this kick about how we can liquefy coal and produce basically diesel fuel, and that it doesn't produce any air pollution. Is there something to that?
I don't know. I mean, it's easier to say than to do.
Mm-hmm.
But there are, you know, innovation really still is a hopeful way for us to figure out how to get out of some of these problems. And I just don't know enough about that technology to know if it's real or fabricated.
Yeah, yeah. Julian Simon, bless his crazy right-wing brain, actually was right on that one point in his debate with Paul Ehrlich, that human ingenuity should never be discounted.
Absolutely. And you know, and especially if we sort of combine it with us being ingenious about learning from nature.
Yeah.
There's a lot we can do. It's not just Velcro that we can learn from animals.
There you go. We're speaking with Charlotte Brody. She's the executive director of Commonweal, a nonprofit health and environmental research institute in Bolinas, California. Charlotte, what are phthalates?
Phthalates. It's a word that's harder to spell than almost any other word in the English language. Phthalate. And these are chemicals that are added to a variety of products, and especially plastics. So all of us have some experience with phthalates if we've ever had a car. The plastic car seats are vinyl. Often in older cars, the dashboard was made out of vinyl. And vinyl naturally is a hard petrochemical-based plastic. And to make it soft enough to turn into fake leather, you have to add phthalates. And over time, the phthalates come out of the vinyl.
Hmm.
And that's
into the air?
Into the air.
Hmm.
That's why old car seats crack.
Hmm.
Right? The phthalates over time, especially heat, being touched to our nice fatty bodies, the phthalates come out and get into the air, get absorbed into us, and it's the film that's on the inside of the car if you've left it out in the sun on a really hot day.
You mean the film on the inside of the windshield?
Yeah, that's the phthalates coming out.
Well, that's interesting.
So the problem is that they get into us, and they can get into us into quantities that can impact health. The phthalates for a long time sort of got ignored because they're not much of a carcinogen.
Mm-hmm.
And we really often think of cancer as sort of the synonym for dangerous. But there are other ways that chemicals can impact human health. They can impact the fetus at levels that never harm adults.
Aren't phthalates endocrine mimickers?
They are endocrine mimickers, but what they do at the lowest level of exposure is they act as what's called reproductive toxins. They impact the developing reproductive organs. In animal studies and in a landmark study last year, Shana Swan showed that they also seem to be impacting baby boys.
Now that we know this, are they being taken out of our environment?
Well, not because the government is doing it, but we've done an enormous amount of work in healthcare without harm in moving the healthcare industry away from using PVC, because the phthalates in PVC are one of the biggest sources of medical exposures. And now in the Safe Cosmetics campaign, we're doing a lot of work with personal care companies to try to get them to take phthalates out of personal care products.
So phthalates are the softeners, the plasticizers.
They're softeners. They're also in some nail polishes because they keep all the other ingredients mixed together, so you don't have to shake the bottle.
So they're an
much.
Emulsifier, as it were.
Yeah. Well, and they keep the fragrance in bottles of perfume. So they're used for a variety of different uses, but the problem with that is that all the different uses can add up to harm in the human body.
Amazing. Charlotte Brody, she is the executive director of the Commonweal Institute. More information at commonweal.org or safecosmetics.org. Charlotte, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
And there's an issue that has come to my attention, the issue of the so-called global warmings that are happening on our planet. For centuries, the rays of the sun have warmed the surface of our Earth's crust. And apparently those rays are intensifying in such a way that it's increasing lava flows. And
cut!
I'm not going to lie to you, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Razzle-dazzle
them,
let those blue states complain.
Yeah. Welcome back,
my friend. It'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah.
Just so long as I'm the dictator.
There you go. Welcome back. Bush declared the economy strong and gaining steam. This is from the Australian, right? This is how the world sees us. The world, this is the Australian, one of the two large national newspapers in Australia, David Nason writing his report from Wall Street from the United States. This is tragic. George Bush declared the economy, quote, strong and gaining steam, end quote, and rattled off the positives. A healthy 3.5% growth rate, unemployment down to 4.7%, more than 4 million new jobs created in the past 30 months, home ownership at record levels, and after-tax income up 8% since 2001. We're doing fine, Bush assured his audience before posing the rhetorical question. How do we keep doing fine? Bush's three waves of the Bush magic wand provided the answer. Low taxation, careful government spending, and the wonders of modern technology. Well, then reality sets in. 3 days after this speech, the U.S. Federal Reserve published its triennial survey of consumer finances, while Second Harvest, the nation's largest domestic hunger relief organization, released the latest figures on U.S. poverty. The data give a different perspective of the, quote, fine, end quote, U.S. economy. The Consumer Report showed that median net worth in the U.S. has grown just 1.5% between 2001 and 2004, the period of the Bush administration, compared with 10.3% in the 3 years before 1998 to 2001, before Bush became president. Let's see. 3 years of Clinton, 10%. 4 years of Bush, 1.5%. Everything's just fine. The reduction was mainly due to a sharp rise in household debt, particularly home mortgage debt, and a decline in real wages. Adjusted for inflation, wages have actually fallen 6.2%. But the most alarming news, now keep in mind, this is in the Australian. The most alarming news was the growing number of people in Bush's fine economy who are hungry. The Second Harvest report, using figures compiled before Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, showed that 25, this is before people started living in tents for Hurricane Katrina and Rita, showed that 25 million Americans had been forced to get food from the organization's network of food banks, soup kitchens, and shelters in 2005, up 9% from 2001. The hungry included 9 million children and 3 million elderly people. The trend is reflected in data collected last year by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which found that more than 38 million Americans lived in hungry or, quote, food insecure, end quote, households, an increase of 5 million since Bush became president. In the fine economy of George W. Bush, that is serious food for thought, notes the Australian. The Australian. Now, in today's Wall Street Journal, I mean, it's just, I guess if you're making millions of dollars, if you're making, oh, well, as Paul Krugman points out, if you're making over $6 million a year, your income is up over 400%. So, you know, Limbaugh's doing okay, but the rest of us, things are tough out there. New home sales fell in January, And the number of unsold homes in the market rose to a nearly a 10-year high, signaling continuing cooling in the housing market. Single-family homes dropped 5%. This is from Christopher Conkey in today's Wall Street Journal. Single-family homes dropped 5% last month to an annual rate of 1.23 million units, the slowest pace in a year. He notes most economists were surprised by the January decline, having anticipated that unseasonably warm weather last month would boost sales. Rising interest rates and lower levels of mortgage applications in recent weeks have further darkened the outlook. Yesterday's report was viewed as the latest evidence that the housing market is undergoing a gradual slowdown rather than a sharp freefall. I guess that's the good news. You know, it's what might be the bad news? Well, as the Associated Press notes, orders to U.S. factories for big-ticket manufactured goods fell by the largest amount in 5.5 years in January. See, the January figures are coming in, and it's not looking good. Everything from computers to cars fell by 10.2% last month, a much bigger decline than had been expected. Orders for non-defense capital goods fell by 20% in January. See, the only thing that is holding this economy together right now is the fact that the Bush administration is spending a couple billion dollars a week on military goods to be shipped to Iraq. That's no way to run an economy. I'm telling you, it's no way to run an economy. And then on top of that, of course, you got Don Rumsfeld trying to destroy the ability of Defense Department employees to have collective bargaining. Today, U.S. District Judge Emmett G. Sullivan rejected the argument made by Rumsfeld in 2003, finding that the new Pentagon personnel system violates the law. He says, as was the case in Chertoff 1, this court concludes that the new rule fails to ensure even minimal collective bargaining rights. A big victory for 700,000 Pentagon employees working to defend our country who deserve better than to have their own defense secretary trying to strip away their rights. But he'll keep at it. It's the conservative way, don't you know? 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Compete with you, beat or cheat or mistreat you, simplify you, pacify you, deny, defy or crucify you. All I really wanna do is maybe be friends with you.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Three brothers, Neil, Jeb, and W, were stumbling home late one night and found themselves on a road that led past an old graveyard. Come over here and have a look, says Neil. It's Obadiah Jones's grave. God bless his soul. He lived the ripe old age of 87. That's nothing, says Jeb. There's one named Butch Smith. Says here that he was 95 when he died. Just then, W yells out, but here's a feller who died when he was 145 years old. What was his name, asked Neil. And W looks carefully and says, Miles from Austin. Anyhow, speaking of W, 145 miles, you get it? No, it's David doesn't get it. Yeah, you got it. Okay. All right. The Bush administration is now taking the ownership society to its... This is way beyond a logical extreme, to its absurd extreme. As David Rogers writes in today's Wall Street Journal, ownership dose for Medicare, Bush proposes rent to own for elderly's oxygen equipment. And right now, if you're in the last, you know, when by the time people get to be where they have, they're living on oxygen, they usually don't have that much longer to go, and tragically. And so they rent oxygen units. And President Bush Ownership Society is coming to one corner of Medicare. Live long enough and a patient can have his or her own oxygen equipment and hospital-style bed at home. Right. Administration contends that the rental payments now are a waste of scarce government funds. You see, the way it was now, right now, Medicare rents these things and you use them. So what Bush wants to do is he wants to say, okay, the oxygen equipment, after 13 months of rental, you own it. We're not going to pay for it anymore, in other words. And by the way, the oxygen that you're inhaling, you're going to have to negotiate that on your own, because the Republicans know that in a free market, if you have an opportunity to negotiate things, you'll get a better deal. So you could just see some old guy on an oxygen tank dialing oxygen. I'd like to know if you've got... come on, give me a break, guys. This is incredible. Robert Berenson, senior fellow at the Urban Institute, top Medicare administrator under President Clinton. He says, Republican delusions that health care can work like any other market apparently know no bounds. They now even extend their notion of an ownership society to people in their last months of life. He also points out that if after 13 months people own the equipment, but then they have to rent the oxygen tanks, that what you're going to see is the same thing you see right now with printers, computer printers. Have you noticed that you can get a computer printer for pretty much free these days? There's a reason for that. Because they make all their money selling you the ink. The copy machine companies figured this out a long time ago. It's been a business model for decades. You know, they don't make any money selling you these printers. In many cases, they lose money on the printers. But, you know, once they've got you buying their ink, they've got you. And so the unintended consequence, as if to quote David Rogers in the Wall Street Journal, one unintended consequence is the economic pressure to build cheaper, less durable products given the 13-month cap imposed on bed rentals. So you're going to see beds that are only good for 13 months. You're going to see oxygen canisters that are only good for 13 months. Or you're going to see an increase in the price of the oxygen that goes into it. This is, he says, already monthly rental payments have been cut. Allowed charges rose to $2.78 billion in 2004, a 71% increase since 1998 that reflects a growing demand. Right now, there's law being put forth by mobilizing Ohio Republicans. Invacare was able to beat back Representative Thomas's late-night effort to impose an 18-month cap. This is, they're talking now about Medicaid. In Ohio, the Republicans have got it, so after 3 years, you own the equipment. And they're trying to make that 18 months, and that's got them all flipped out. So the ownership society coming to a deathbed near you. Is there no end? I mean, is there no disgrace? After a while, you just, you know, cease to be shocked by it, I suppose. It just, you just reach the point where, you know, it's just, that's the Bushies, that's the Republicans. Oh, my. It's time for our Berlusconi alert. Yes, indeed. If we can hand over our ports to the United Arab Emirates, then it makes sense that Berlusconi can get the Intrepid Freedom Award. Our Berlusconi alert theme music here. Oh, Solo Mia. Yes, it's all about Berlusconi. Silvio Berlusconi, of course, the small-time crook and businessman. Many of his early business associates now in prison because of their activities with him. But in the course of building his business empire, he bought a TV station, and then he bought a radio station, and then he bought another TV station, another radio station, then he bought a newspaper, then a TV network, then a radio network, then another newspaper, then a magazine, then a magazine, then another magazine, then a newspaper, then another TV, then another TV network, and pretty soon, Silvio Berlusconi owned all the TV networks, except the state-run network, their equivalent of public broadcasting, all the radio networks, except for their equivalent of public broadcasting, there, and most of the newspapers. In fact, he owned media that reached 95% of all Italians. And 95% of all the media consumed by Italians was owned by one man, Silvio Berlusconi. So what did he do? Well, of course, he ran for prime minister. Well, actually, he put together a party that would elect him prime minister. And guess what? He won! What a surprise. So today, Berlusconi having breakfast with George W. Bush, along with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, just hours before Bush leaves for Asia. Why? Because in 6 weeks, Italy is having elections, and Berlusconi's not doing so well. So the whole point of this is to make Berlusconi look good, and hey, you know, he's sucking up to Bush, and it's grabbing some media attention. As Charles Kupchan, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, said,
Berlusconi is in the midst of a massive effort to attract attention to his candidacy. He is on television every night, and there's no better way to focus media than to visit the United States. Well, yeah, of course. Italy, by the way, is Iran's biggest trading partner. And during his visit, he's going to be given the Intrepid Freedom Award, which in past years has gone to Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. There you go. That, and a cautionary tale, by the way, of what can happen when you let one man buy the media, all the media of a country. Why not just abolish the Secret Service, they say over at the Pensita Review blog. Why not, let's just abolish the Secret Service and let the United Arab Emirates guard the president. This is show our Arab allies that we trust them. Better yet, let's outsource the pilots of Air Force One. I don't know. It's at a certain level, that's starting to get into the xenophobia or the Arabophobia that Jim Zogby has been talking about. There really is this clear divide. The Republicans have created this absolute hysteria. I mean, Bush has worked so hard to cause us to, as he would say, these all quotes. This is just a few clips from his speech before the Republican National Convention, as he would cause us to
be afraid. September the 11th, we saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you. Evil God, Iraq, darkness, the continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. We have fought the terrorists across the earth. The evil. We are staying on the offensive, striking terrorists abroad, and nothing will hold us back, and we will prevail. Be afraid. God bless America. Nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat, and Al-Qaeda was largely unchallenged as it planned attacks. Free Afghanistan, terror, Pakistan, terrorists, Saudi Arabia, Libya, weapons programs, Saddam Hussein, terror, weapons of mass destruction. The Almighty God, the dictator, Afghanistan, terrorists of Afghanistan and Iraq. Fight terrorists, various terrorist enemies we are facing in Iraq. We are defeating the terrorists doing battle in Afghanistan and Iraq. The resurrection, Saddam Hussein's secret police, sadistic punishment, mass graves, radical ideology of hate, kill the innocent, tyranny and terror.
So there you have just 1 minute from George W. Bush's Republican National Committee speech. I mean, you know, it's an aggregate minute, of course. And so he's out there basically saying there's these nasty people, and they happen to be Arabs and Muslims, and we should all be afraid of them. And now he's saying, but, you know, let's sell our ports to them. And there's this disconnect going on. And among the Republicans, and particularly the more racist element of the Republicans, there's a major disconnect of, you're talking about those people. But for many Americans, it really doesn't have so much to do with buying into Bush's fear-mongering, although that's really what's coming home to roost, coming home to haunt him, as it has to do with, you know, that guy who Tim McVeigh had spent the night at his house before he went and blew up the place, and this guy ends up in prison for life. You know who I'm talking about? I don't have his name in front of me, but this guy, he's in jail. Terry Nichols was his name. Here's Terry Nichols. You know, Tim McVeigh spends the night at his house on his way to blow up and he's in jail forever. Well, the UAE guys, they were partying with Bin Laden. 45 minutes back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
From your lips to God's ears, Leonard Cohen, let's hope so.
George W. Bush running around saying, this was just a couple of months ago, December 18th of 2005. He says, it's also important for every American to understand the consequences of pulling out of Iraq before our work is done. We would undermine the morale of our troops by betraying the cause for which they have sacrificed. What was that cause? Oh, yes, getting the Republicans reelected in 2002 and taking the Senate and reelected in 2004. That's right. Well, now it turns out somebody has finally asked the soldiers what they think about all this. This was a Zogby poll co-sponsored by the Le Moyne College, a Catholic school in upper New York State, I believe, and conducted by Zogby International. New poll released today. 23% of soldiers backed George Bush's position that we should stay in Iraq as long as necessary. 72% of soldiers want us to be pulled out within 1 year. Of those, 29% want us to withdraw now, immediately, in quotes, immediately. 29%, 72% within a year. So if the soldiers can figure this out, and the last I looked, they were on the ground, why can't Bush? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Tom in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. As you're aware of, I believe this is just a marketing and an advertising issue. And so what I would encourage is for the Democrats to kind of...
Hang on just a second. What's the this that you're talking about here, Tom?
The political rhetoric that we're receiving from the far right.
About
every issue, be it the war, the economy, the environment. And so what I would suggest is that individuals like yourself lay down the gauntlet to individuals like the Rush Limbaughs and the right-wing rhetoric machine and challenge them to an open debate.
Tom, we spend, David Poole, my producer, who's sitting 5 feet from me right now with an ironic grin on his face, probably spends 3 or 4 hours a week in aggregate contacting conservatives, right-wing talk show hosts, right-wing think tanks, people who have written articles, right-wingers who have written articles on Newsmax.com and other right-wing websites, asking them to come on this program. And what we, you know, the folks at the Ayn Rand Institute, God bless them, I have been willing to come on, you know, week after week and just tell their story. And whether they perceive it as get beat up or not, I don't know, you know, how they think of it, but they keep coming back. And occasionally we'll get somebody from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, but that's it. The Heritage Foundation won't send us folks anymore. It's just everybody is, they don't want the discussion, Tom. They just don't want the discussion. They will not engage in it. And I tell people, my callers, if somebody calls and says that they are conservative and or they disagree with me, they go to the front of the line. And you can tell how many conservatives are you know, have the guts to call in.
Well, I agree with you, sir. My question is that instead of trying to do it that would be on an individual show basis, why not take a grassroots approach and get advertising on national advertising that says we want to discuss the issues, and if people are unwilling to even get into conversation, at least the American public will see from a national forum, it can be mediated by anybody they choose, but the issues are going to speak for themselves.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. See, that's why they won't engage with the issues. And in fact, what you're finding, Tom, is that right now the right wing is starting to just rapidly melt down. You're familiar with Judicial Watch, Larry Klayman's old organization? They're the
Correct.
Ones who did the initial lawsuit about Jennifer Flowers that led to the discovery of Monica Lewinsky, that led to the downfall
Our
of Bill Clinton.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. They just sued the White House today. This was filed in U.S. District Court today. They sued the White House and the Secret Service for access to the White House visitors' logs. They want to find out how many times Jack Abramoff met with George Bush and what was going on. And what do you think that they might also be discovering in the process, and this might be one of the things that the White House is trying to cover up, how many times Jeff Gannon Guckert was in the White House and who he was meeting with on those more than 200 times that he showed up at the White House when there were no press conferences going on. I mean, this is a White House with a lot to cover up. It ain't going to happen. But Tom, I think that your heart and your mind are in the right place, and I appreciate your calling and your comments. It's not going to happen. In the meantime, unfortunately, I mean, we keep trying. We keep trying. We keep pushing on this thing, and we keep inviting them to come on the program because I really think that it is a good thing for America for this kind of dialogue to happen and for it not to be a I shout you down or I pot you down if I don't like what you say kind of thing, but to actually let people have their say and, you know, them let me have my say and we'll have a conversation about it. And occasionally it happens. Occasionally it happens. In the meantime, Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld recently gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations and said something very strange. He was talking about the need for the Department of Defense to be essentially planting news, controlling news, phony news. He said, "We meet today in the sixth year of what promises to be a long struggle against an enemy that in many ways is unlike any our country has ever faced. And in this war, some of the most critical battles may not be in the mountains in Afghanistan or in the streets of Iraq, but in newsrooms, in newsrooms, in places like New York, London, Cairo, and elsewhere." In New York, Don Rumsfeld telling the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, he's got to do war in New York. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Robert Alvarez, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary for National Security, says beneath the surface of nuclear boosterism and public diplomacy on the India deal with the U.S. are some troubling issues. Jeffrey Feldman is going to tell us about how Bush has broken the frame, strong wall and guard the gates. Listen, your calls on the next Tom Hartman radio program. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.